Incredible show today, incredible guest. I've been really wanting to do this one for a while because I know about Peter and I know about his backstory, but I want to hear from him about how he dealt with such an incredible tragedy and loss, but also how he transitioned from the federal government later on in his life, because that's something I'm about to jump into as well. We're also joined by the casual co-host, BC Sanders. He's been around a bunch of times, but hey, Peter, BC, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jason.
You know, Peter, we probably could have talked for about 45 more minutes before we started the show. And that's one thing we always do is we forget to hit record. But you've dealt with a lot in your life. And, you know, you and I came from the same agency, you know, U.S. Customs back in the day. And then I went on to like 17 different other agencies. But you retired from Homeland Security Investigations after a very, very lengthy and incredible career, man. So congratulations on that. I know it's been 5 years, but I'm excited to talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. You know, that long career, when you start thinking about going out the door or you're walking out the door, you kind of, I kind of got the feeling like I was like Brooks in Shawshank Redemption, you know, like, was I going to be able to make it on the outside, you know, to leave what you know. And in a way, you know, I used to joke that like we were like institutionalized inside of this government agency. And now like they're kicking us out the door and it's like, all right, it's all yours. So, yeah, it's not easy. It's hard, and harder for others.
And Customs was a great agency. I used to like being under the Treasury umbrella and different money, different funding, different. I mean, you could do everything because a lot of people understand is like, anything that comes and goes across that border has an international nexus. And that's kind of where the investigations, Homeland Security Investigations does, and the former U.S. Customs Office of Investigation. So you could have your hands in a ton of different things, from narcotics to money to arms trafficking to trade security controls to equities. I mean, what do you call it? Antiquities. That's what I mean. So you could really have your hand in everything.
Yeah. You know, I was fortunate that even in my customs career. So my 31-year federal law enforcement career is 16 years in the customs service and then 15 in the modernized, you know, HSI. And I can say that in my 10 years in Miami, that's where I started. You know, I worked marine interdiction. I worked counterproliferation, counterterrorism, child exploitation. I got to be an undercover, you know.
Well, let's stop right there. Miami, marine interdiction. And what years are we talking about here?
So I started February of 1987.
Oh, what is that? That's like the cocaine cowboy days right there.
Yeah, I mean, that's when like all the go fast boats, boats with concealed compartments were coming across from the Bahamas into South Florida. And so, yeah, it was kind of like a wild, wild west show. Lots going on. But, yeah, lots of fun. You know, I cut my teeth as a what I considered a customs marine law enforcement guy. That was like the first 2 years of my career. Did a lot of time over in the Bahamas because we had a joint operation with our Bahamian counterparts. So, you know, besides getting to explore all of this like Southeast Florida coastal area, I got to explore all over the Bahamas. And it was an incredible experience. Exactly what I wanted, because prior to working for Customs, I was going to the University of Miami. I was a full-time Miami Beach lifeguard. So for 2 years, junior and senior year, I worked full-time on the beach. I'd see these marine law enforcement boats coming and going, the Customs boats, Blue Thunder. It was like I set my eyes, my sights on that. And I was pleasantly surprised that when I was hired, that was the job that I was placed in. So, you know, I kind of felt like I won the lottery from the day I walked in the door.
It does feel like that. And one thing, they just had a job opening for, I believe it was HSI, for student trainees. They're bringing that whole program back. Because back in the day, if you were in U.S. Customs and you went to college, and you almost like an intern, but you're a student trainee, you can get hired right off the bat. Can you imagine being a 23, 24-year-old, having done an internship, and all of a sudden you're thrust into this world? Now, I do like having people that come in with prior military, prior law enforcement and stuff, but if you can mold someone into an agent right off the bat, it's kind of a cool opportunity as well.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, I consider when I started, it wasn't even the analog world. It's what I called the clipboard world. So like in this modern digital world with all of these tools, resources, online type stuff, I mean, it's unbelievable the opportunity that lays ahead and the career that would lays ahead for a new special agent. You know, I just think that there's just so much that they can get their arms around, where before, you know, it's pretty much like what you knew, you know, person to person, you know, there were mm-hmm. resources.
I like how you say the analog world, you know, because it's funny when I started, I was Border Patrol, then I was Customs in 2002. And it was the pager, the two cell phones, the Thomas guides. There was no GPS really back then. It was the Thomas guides. And if anybody doesn't know, a Thomas guide is like a map book, and it's with grids, and you're kind of have to figure out where you're going. And good luck, you know, I remember like when you're doing undercover ops and you're doing ops, with you have your radios going, you got like cell phones, and you're like, I don't even know where we are. I'm like, I remember pulling over people and going, where am I? And they're like, because we're up in LA coming from San Diego, and you know, LA is a mess. So yeah, man, Miami, Fastpost, that must have been so cool.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you talk about the Thomas guide, because like I met, when I finally got to an investigative group, I'm working with this female agent, and in her back seat of her G-Ride was the white pages and the yellow pages.
Yeah.
And you were lucky if you could somehow steal, like there was like a reverse directory.
Yeah, remember that?
Backwards, right, that the information, the white and yellow pages. So yeah, it's some serious old school, you know, shoe leather type work for sure.
Well, what's crazy now is you can have people in the modern day getting stopped in Miami-Dade, anywhere actually in the U.S., and tapping into resources across the U.S. and figure out that people are mobile, and especially either in the drug trade, human trafficking, terrorism. Obviously, it's amazing now what someone can do who's motivated on a case and can tap into those resources and then actually contact someone in another agency by just searching on the internet. You get a phone number, or you say, hey, who knows somebody in Miami-Dade? I mean, in our area, I can ask a friend of a friend and I'll have the hard charger out of Miami, you know, or the hard charger in Atlanta or wherever it is, and then tap into their resources and be like, yeah, we got a guy linked to like three different cities now doing, you know, whatever it is. Where back then everything was so isolated and hard to make those connections that they were probably thriving quite a bit, you know?
And in customs, we were like ahead of the game. We were pretty advanced, right, Jason?
Yeah.
We had like a great radio system. We had the Treasury Enforcement Communication System, their computer. When I started working at FBI on the JTTF, they were still had the index card system. So if they wanted to run a name, they'd have to write the name down, date of birth, give it to a clerk. She or he would go through these alphabetical index cards, look for those case references, you know. And then if you wanted to run the person in another city, you'd have to call those clerks.
It was like clerks to clerk. It wasn't even like intel. And a lot of thing with the Bureau, too, was like they couldn't type their own reports. They would have their 302s transcribed, go into paper folders. At least when we had text was almost like a DOS-based program. But text back in the day, even back nowadays, unbelievable. But you could upload all the phone numbers in your cases in a telephone linking system and link telephones. And that was the greatest thing. You could link telephones to other cases throughout the country. But now, man, the clearinghouses they have out there, and like you were saying, BC, is like there is so much linking together. But also, there's not a lot of sharing as much as like, you know, there should be.
I would challenge that, at least in my perspective, like my experience. Like I have had a lot of people share info with me, and conversely, I'll share anything with anybody. I do believe that about, for us, at least about 10 years ago, somewhere around there in our area, in our department, we were kind of known as not playing friendly. So it was like we were stereotyped at like, oh, they're too arrogant. They don't want to share information. So when I'm asking for information, people are blowing me off, and I didn't understand why. And so then when I heard the rumors, I'm like, oh, so I just have to offer information up front and change that stereotype. But years ago, it was compartmentalized.
So Peter, what was that transition like? That's one thing I want to talk about. Like, cause I got a couple weeks left and, I was nervous, but now I'm like, let's do this. Let's get on. You know, I pushed my retirement a couple months cause I was like, I don't want to lose paychecks in this, but when you jumped out, I mean, that must've been really interesting to turn in that badge and gun.
Yeah, I kind of describe it as being Brooks in the Shawshank Redemption. You're walking out the door and you don't know what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. You kind of have that butterfly in your stomach. I had a job lined up. But it is not easy. And it's not easy to even get that first job. It takes some work. I think after being, as I describe, institutionalized in a federal law enforcement agency for so long, you tend to write a certain way. You write reports, you write memos, requesting things. So when it even comes time to prepare your resume, it takes like you need to rewire it. I remember I consulted with two retired special agents in charge, and I had them look at my resume, and they were like, cut this out, take that out. They don't care about that. These statistics don't mean anything. You know, you need to show if you're going to be leading, like I was going to be leading a public safety department at a small community college. It was like, they need to know things about like your duty of care for your people and making sure that they're trained and talk about the stats involving like on the job injuries or vehicle accidents, like all that other, dope on the table, pictures with your buddies. That's stuff.
That's gone.
get rid of that. And so it took a while, and I figured it out. And then once I kind of became familiar with that mindset, then when I went to interview and I got an interview, I think I was able to crack the code. But unless I had that help from somebody that had already gone forth and did it themselves, it was pretty hard to do it on your own, even for a guy that has 31 years. I climbed the ladder from special agent all the way up to ASAC. I was a deputy attache. I held great, great jobs or positions in the agency, but I still needed help to get that first job coming out the door.
Well, not to mention that doesn't translate to anyone out in the private sector. Like they don't, I mean, you'd have to explain like, hey, that means I'm in charge. You know what I mean? Like hundreds of people and making, decisions that are going to last for the next 30 years, $1 million budgets and stuff. The only reason I say is like when I got out of the Army as an E5, I was nothing, but I had a platoon sergeant that was like, you better get ready, man. The three bears are waiting for you. And I was like, the three bears? He's like, bear pocket, bear stomach, and bear ass. I was like, oh, okay, I got it. Now I got to fend for myself because the Army provided food, shelter, clothing, everything. So he's like, when you get out there, you got to hustle and you have to basically show everybody what these 4 years in the Army did. Not just learn how to shoot weapons and buff floors, but your leadership skills and how do those apply. And the resume thing, I was just talking to somebody last night about services that you can actually hire people to, like you were kind of saying, you had some friends to help you, like these services that help you write the resume, which kind of blows my mind. But also I haven't been asked to do that just because of someone in a photography field having trouble with resumes, but just trying to get your foot in the door. I think for a lot of people, they get overwhelmed or maybe they, I don't know, they kind of talk themselves out of those positions where you were like, hey, I'm going to apply for this one, even though maybe someone thinks that wouldn't be applicable to your background. It sounds like you got the job, right? And you made it happen.
Yeah. And it took me a couple of times to get the job because I applied once and I didn't get it. And then I guess they hired somebody and then it didn't work out. Then they reannounced. And then I came back stronger, like from that experience, which is very, very true of like our careers in law enforcement at whatever level, is that you learn, like the most experienced people did not succeed every time. Mm-hmm. Like the people that are that perform at a high level are very experienced because they've had failures and they know how to recover and adjust. You know, whether it's adjust fire, adjust tactics, techniques, invent new techniques and tactics, procedures. Those are the most successful people because they've never succeeded every time at bat, you know.
Mm-hmm. I would also say probably ego free, like people that just kind of check that ego and go, it doesn't matter what I've done for the last 20 years, 30 years. Like you said, what can I do moving forward? And not, I don't know, kind of be boosted up by that, but I don't know.
And all the war stories, that's for like, I call it now like entertainment purposes. I can stand at any bar and tell war stories until closing time, till last call. But that really, unless you can translate the lesson learned right within that story, you know, you put it on paper, you put it, you know, you convey that during a podcast or an interview, that's where the value is, you know. But the story by itself, if you can't understand the lesson or the why or the how it really happened, and because us people make it happen, right? We're the greatest resource in these agencies.
Mm-hmm.
People. It's not the computer system. You know, it's not the rifle. It's not the whatever.
The tools.
Yeah. So it's all about us, right?
Well, that's one thing you bring up too, is like, so you've had a long career. You've done a lot of different things, but you're continuously learning. You've taken your lessons learned, and now you brought up a good point before we hit record, was about preparedness, education. I mean, you could have all the tools in a world and all the resources in a world, but if you're not prepared to use them or even know how to use them, that's an interesting thing. So you become more of an educator. And that's kind of like what BC said, was once you check your ego and you could convey your thoughts without everybody going, oh God, this guy's blowing smoke up our ass because he thinks he's great, then you get to a different level. And that's one thing I want to talk about now, is like, you are moving on to this next level of, you know, providing a resource.
Yeah. So, you know, I have my own LLC. It's called the Hallover Consulting. On the internet, it's hallerverconsulting.com. So I'm working here in Central Oregon where I live, trying to increase the preparedness and resiliency of people that live here through education. So when I worked at the community college, I saw that the college didn't need more like security and safety officers. They actually needed more knowledge. Like the students, the faculty, the staff needed to know what to bring in emergency. They needed to know how to stay informed about what's going on around them. They needed to know how to call in an emergency appropriately. How to use life-saving equipment. They needed to get some life-saving training, because in reality, they're the first responders. They're the one that's going to see the person fall on the floor from a heart attack, right? Not, you know, fire rescue. Fire rescue kind of ends up being the second responder, right? So if the first responders can really make a difference with knowledge, right? And, you know, I saw in this institution that they had all of these cabinets with AEDs, you know, like in all the different buildings, yet nobody knew how to use them. Nobody even knew what they were and what they could do. And so I realized then, it's like, oh yeah, the value that we need to bring to this community, and it's essentially like a small community, is education in this whole everyday emergency disaster preparedness area. And really what it does is it frees up the first responders, you know, on a larger scale to really deal with the true emergencies, right? Instead of, you know, these minor things. That,
yeah, there's such a shortage in that. Right. This other, I don't even know how to like really talk about this topic and how to really start this topic, you know. BC and I are both fathers, and you've had such an incredible loss. And it's like, how do you talk about, how do you even talk about that loss and being, having like, you know, your whole life? Cause you know, once you become a father, it's like you dedicate your life to your kids. And then you had a son, US Marine, that died tragically. And I really want to talk about how you deal with that. I mean, I want to know, but that's the one thing we talked about before with like this podcast is like, you could tell war stories all day. You could tell this all day. You could, you know, pat yourself on the back, but when like the lesson, the learning, and I want to learn, I want to know how you dealt with that, Peter. And I kind of want to, and it's not just that. It's like people always say, like, as long as you say someone's name, they're always going to live on. So I'd like to talk about that as much as we could and as much as you're comfortable about.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because talking about it is important, and it is the path. So my son, his name's Jack Ryan. He's a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps. He was killed in training with 8 others when their amphibious assault vehicle sank off San Clemente Island. They were doing pre-deployment training, getting ready to go on deployment. And, you're never prepared for something like that to happen. You know, our son was very ambitious, looking forward to blazing his own trail through military service. We were very proud of him. We were proud of that he was pursuing his dream of being a U.S. Marine. And, he loved being a Marine, and we loved that he loved being a Marine. And I can tell you that, I'd retired, that 31 year career was like the second love of my life besides my wife. And I was ready to kind of, and I would call it like, it's like youth sports again, to stand on the sidelines and watch Jack, become this Marine and young man and progress in his career. You know, I was ready to stand on those sidelines and cheer him on and encourage him and support him however I could. And that's the role that I found myself in. And then this tragedy happens, completely preventable. There's been a lot written about it, a lot, TV. I testified before the House Armed Services Committee's Subcommittee on Readiness about it. I was interviewed by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes about it. But the bottom line is it could have been prevented, completely preventable. But so what do you do? When that happens to you and it happens to your family, you start questioning everything. You start questioning, did I do something in my life that somehow I deserve this, this to happen to me, and things like that. You start, those kinds of things cross your mind. And then what you realize is that, whether you believe in a creator or not, creator can't alter the trajectory of bullets, ballistic metal, on the battlefield. There's not a creator that had it in for my family and the 8 other families, and somehow he decided to put them all together so that they would all pay the price together. I don't believe that. But I do believe that there's randomness. Things happen. Bad things do happen to good people. That's kind of the randomness of this world, right? You see it everywhere when bad things happen to good people. What do you do moving forward? Well, once we found out what really happened, which was that a bunch of people that were responsible for my son, his leaders, essentially fell down on the job, cutting corners, assigning poor conditioned amphibious assault vehicles to this unit, to this Marine Expeditionary Unit. There would be tantamount guys to, in the back lot at the police station or the office, all those deadline police cars and G rides. It's like you say, like, all right, we're using those for this operation. Cars that are dead, cars that are broken down, hobbling and wobbling, And that's what they did. And then what else did they do? They skipped training. And they needed to participate and complete underwater egress training, where they learn how to get out of those vehicles if there's an incident, learn how to evacuate, learn how to transfer to other vehicles, learn how to get in the water with PFDs to save themselves. They completely skip that training. And so, you know, I attended some of the boards of inquiry, and essentially my son's battalion commander, his company commander, were found to have had substandard performance of duties, although they were retained. They were not kicked out of the Marine Corps because, you know, the battalion commander was within a year of retirement. So he had been riding a desk since the incident. And in his current position, he was performing great. He wasn't leading people anymore, but yet he was performing great as a desk jockey. The company commander had been put in charge of a company over at like the MEF headquarters, that it was like a company full of people preparing to go before boards of inquiry. So, you know, nobody lost their job, although they were found to have substandard performance of duties. And so, you know, you can imagine for people like us how that makes you feel, right? There is an aspect of anger and frustration. Somehow you want to make it right, or you want to see that it is right. And I guess what I've come to realize is that that anger is like a natural emotion. There's no like shutting it off or like locking it away. You're going to be angry. I'm still angry about that their leadership had failed. But it's what you do with the anger, which is important, you know. So I've been able to channel some of that into speaking out about the lack of readiness and the shortcomings and the lack of meaningful accountability, because really there was no meaningful accountability. And, you know, what I came to find out was, you know, so my son was lost with eight others, but yet that entire battalion that day was placed at risk, all 140 of them. And that's not to be taken lightly. And we found out some things that happened that day as well. Other vehicles that broke down, other vehicles that appeared to have been sinking themselves. What I can say is that when this kind of trauma happens to you, you start questioning everything, and then everything's on the table as well. So I can tell you that, you know, I've thought of everything from checking out, you know, suicide to doing some things that would perhaps place me at risk of incarceration, you know, place me at risk of losing my family's financial resources. And so all those things all of a sudden appear, you know, like they're on that table in front of you and you're thinking about all those things. But then when I started to evaluate that, I realized that what I really wanted was my son back. That's all I wanted. I didn't want anything else. And I think it's in our nature when we're like law enforcement officers, whether you're a fed or state and local, especially if you're involved in investigations, we're like problem solvers. We're looked to come up with solutions. And it came to a point when I recognized that all I want is him back, and it's a problem that I can't solve. I can't deliver on that. And once I accepted that I cannot do anything, whether good or bad, to bring him back, once I accepted it, it brought me some peace. It was like that burden, I took it off of my shoulders. And as silly or crazy as it sounds, but, you know, that's all I wanted. And so relieving myself of that burden has been a great thing. And, you know, I've come to realize also is that, you know, I'm 58 years old. I have a lot of life to live for, a lot of life ahead of me. You know, I have a wife I have a son, another son, who love me. They're counting on me. They're relying on me. So, you know, I need to be around for them, you know, and I need to continue to be that provider. And so, you know, I found this program just by chance on the internet. It's called the Post-Traumatic Winning Program. It's run by a retired Marine major, Michael McNamara. He's in Costa Mesa, California. And, you know, his program taught me that, you know, you need to learn to coexist with trauma because you don't get over the things that traumatize you. And at some point in your life, whether you've experienced trauma or not, you're gonna be proximate to it. Learn that, you know, trauma is trauma is trauma. Like, we're all human beings. We all respond to it in the same way, whether you were subject of child abuse, you were raped, you lost a loved one in a tragic accident, somebody, you know, had cancer or some deadly disease. And that feeling damaged by trauma is normal. You know, it's just a normal part of life. So I've learned that. I've also learned that you have to embrace self-discipline in your life. And what's that? So it's not abusing alcohol and drugs. And frankly, you know, and I'll pose this question to you. Have you ever seen anybody that abused alcohol or drugs that successfully dealt with their trauma?
No.
Right. So it's having that self-discipline to not go there, because typically, you know, alcohol and drugs isolates you, and us as humans, we actually want to connect with people, like we are connected right now talking about this. So having that self-discipline, one of the other items is learning how to handle money well. And I'm not saying being rich, being loaded, it's not exceeding your income, right? You know, living a modest life. So because, you know, financial stress causes you a lot of stress, right? On your relationship and on your well-being. The other thing was to kind of build up some mental fitness infrastructure in your life. So, you know, talking to others, stop faking your mental fitness, being physically fit, you know, because it makes us feel good when we're physically active. You know, we get those endorphins. Also, you know, when you don't have those aches and pains of all these different illnesses, you feel better. So having that infrastructure, maybe adopting some practices like meditation, yoga, whatever, what have you, that supports you. Some people like to read the Daily Stoic. You know, I read it every now and then. So that's important, is to have that mental fitness infrastructure. And then the other thing is to give back to others, which is talking to others about the path, you know, and what I just described to you is this path that can take you from trauma back to joy, to have a more joyful life. But it requires you to be a better version of yourself, you know, and it requires you to have that discipline.
Yeah. When you brought up the faking it, how many of us have faked it? You know, oh, you know, how are you doing? And you're like one step closer to the grave and you're like, I'm doing great. Yeah. I mean, you see it all the time on social media. You see it all the time in like our friends and family. Like, yeah. The next thing you know, like, cause when you talk about like, you know, getting this suicide in your head and you're like, huh, everybody probably looking at you like, well, he's going through a lot of grief. He'll be fine. And you know, you might have the outwardly, but yeah, I mean, I think it's great that you find a path. You have to find a path. And that's one thing I was like, I'm really glad you brought up that you did find places to reach out to, and you did not just go into your shell.
Yeah, it's important, you know, and it's important that to be there for the others that care and love for you, to be for them. And but yeah, the giving is huge, because if you can share some of this what's called post-traumatic wisdom with others, you know, giving to others, as it transforms their life, it transforms your life, right? You get satisfaction from helping somebody else. So that's been very important for me. So, but that being said, it doesn't mean that I'm not angry and that I've
like, and you let, should be angry.
Let it go. I mean, I should be angry. All of the families are angry that there was such a lack of duty of care for those Marines. And, you know, it just seems that time and time again, and I think we saw it, you know, a year later in Kabul, is that, you know, the military hospitals are full of the junior enlisted, right? They're the ones that pay the price, and their families are the ones that pay the price for, I think, the lack of leadership and sometimes the lack of courage by some of the leaders to do the right thing. So, you know, that's probably another podcast.
yeah, I think we could all talk about that all day long about who's paying the price for these wars and corporations and lack of leadership. But, you know, if nobody's holding other people accountable, like you said, you're testifying, you're speaking up, you have to use your voice. If you sit back and you just say, and you let the anger build and you don't use that voice, and we all have it and everybody can speak up. There's ways to get it out there. You could do podcasts, you could write, you can tell these Congress people, you could vote, you could do whatever you have to do to get your anger out without taking that violent step or the non-lawful steps. But you got to keep your voice up, and I could, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's important. And, you know, I can tell you this, that when I came to realize this as I was preparing to testify before the House, was that I was fortunate that I had this 31-year career where I learned how to speak and testify and write. Some of the other families that were involved in the incident with my son didn't have that, what I would call like professional career education, right? Develop the knowledge, skills, and abilities to be able to do that, you know? So in a way, you know, I'm fortunate that I learned all of that during my career and I was able to put it to work, you know, for my son and to, you know, honor him appropriately. So, you know, there's a lot of retrospective that I can look back and it's just like, oh, wow, you know, you've come a long way from a Miami Beach lifeguard who have just a health and fitness management degree. So,
Health and fitness lifeguard.
That's me. I have the claim to fame. I'm pretty certain that I'm the only former Miami Beach lifeguard to have been a U.S. diplomat.
There you go.
There's only one.
Where were you an attaché at?
In London. I was a deputy attaché.
Nice. You know, who's got it better than you?
Yeah, it was pretty nice. You know, it's a great experience to, you know, essentially live in the concrete jungle because I never had. And it was a great experience for my whole family. And, you know, these experiences and like I credit Customs and HSI for like who I am today. You know, people say like, don't define yourself by your job and your career. Well, I certainly do because it gave me all of these opportunities. It trained me. It turned me into a professional. It gave me all these professional life experiences that I would not have had. So I really do. I'm grateful that for everything that I came to experience during that career. And I think the new agents should be grateful that they get that job and they should try to make the best of their careers because really the sky is the limit.
It really is.
Yeah.
What do you got for us, BC?
Sorry about that. I lost audio just for a second. But yeah, I was going to say when you're talking about just defining yourself, I tell people that all the time, but also we are who we are and we didn't get into these fields because we just needed a job, you know? So we sought out this work and we do it and we put it on the line and it cost us a lot. We get with the life that other people would sadly, it's unfulfilled for them.
Oh, yeah, Peter. Certainly, you know, like law enforcement, to me, I've always had this notion is that it's a job for winners. If you're not a winner, I don't know what you're doing in this profession. You know, it is a battle of good versus evil. And if you're not into that, you're not competitive against the bad guys.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're doing. Don't move along, because I know that for HSI, there are thousands of applicants when they open up for new agent positions. So if you're not into it, step aside and let somebody else have a shot.
And, you know, I tell people nowadays, when you're getting into policing, into law enforcement, you don't have to look at it as a career. You can do 4 or 5 years and say, okay, that's good. I got what I wanted out of it. I served one way or the other. You don't have to go into the military to serve. You could serve the community other ways, EMS, fire, volunteer, anything. But you get into law enforcement, you don't have to look at anything as a career anymore. Well, it'd be great. You get in there and you learn, you do what you got to do. But when you get to the point where you're not going to be fulfilled with it anymore and you're not going to be good at countering these bad guys, then maybe it's time to move on and do something else with your life. Because mm-hmm. there are thousands of applicants out there.
Yeah, great point. Great point. Yeah, especially if you develop some kind of expertise that you can use in the outside professional world, whether it's some kind of computer forensics or some kind of technical job. I think that some agencies have more technical services that you can parlay into a career somewhere else. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, Peter, BC, I appreciate you too. It's great to have this conversation today. I definitely want to have you back on, Peter, and we can get into some deeper topics as well, as in let's overhaul the government. We could do it.
Yeah.
BC, you too, man.
Hey, and congratulations.
Appreciate it, buddy. I enjoyed it.
Congratulations to you, Jason. I saw that you were on that list of the sixth friendliest podcast for LEOs and veterans, friendliest. First responders.
Well, we are very friendly here at the Protectors Podcast.
Yes.